believe that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA, recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Ed and Rebecca, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that you may learn here, what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and your understanding. And now we have Holly that will read the preamble. Thank you.
Hello, my name's Holly and I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are a self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Thank you.
Thank you. Please join me in the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Okay, and now we have Tika, who will read the steps.
Hey guys, my name's Tika and I'm an alcoholic. These are the 12 steps. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives have become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry it out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening, as a result of these steps, we try to carry this message to alcoholics and practice these principles in all our affairs. Thanks.
Okay, and now we have Fred to read the traditions.
Hi, I'm Fred, I'm an alcoholic. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as He may express Himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group would never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully supporting declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as a such would never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name would never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Okay, the format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. I'd like to introduce our first 10-minute speaker, Kevin.
Hi, my name's Kevin. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a little nervous, and I really don't like to do this, but I've been asked to do it, and I've learned to do what I'm asked in this program. I woke up this morning, and I didn't have a hangover. I wasn't filled with guilt, shame, or remorse. I wasn't broke. I had a roof over my head. I have a beautiful wife. I have family, and I have friends in my life. I have a job that I go to. I don't really like it, but I go. I earn a living. And, you know, my life, I'm only here because of the grace of God. And I say that, I know if you're a beginner, you're just here for news. It took me a long time to even put God back into my vocabulary. A little bit about myself. My father was born in Germany, my mother was born in Ireland. They met in a bar in New York, so I was destined to be a drunk. And I don't remember my first drink, but I know that growing up, I always felt uncomfortable, uneasy. I was fat. I had like an afro kind of hair, a lot of curls, and that was back in the days when guys were blow drying their hair and they were feathering their hair, and I just couldn't get that thing going. And the only place I felt comfortable was when I was playing sports, but that wasn't all the time. And the first time I picked up a drink, I fell in love. I really did. My mother at that time was a practicing drunk, I should say. Today she's sober a long time, thank God. And, you know, I fell in love. Alcohol did for me everything. You know, it was my solution to my problems, and it worked for a long time. You know, and as time went on, the consequences got greater and greater. And my first sobriety date was actually May 6, 1989. And what brought me in then was I had gotten a car accident. You know, I had almost killed somebody. And I had called, I was 22 at the time, and my mother was in the program, and I called her and I came in. I didn't go to rehab at that time. And I stayed around for 7 years. And I got a home group, I got a sponsor, he took me through the steps. And after about my fifth year, I moved, and I never got reconnected again after that. You know, I went to meetings, but you know, I was more a bystander. I went to meetings, I took people's inventory. I wasn't praying anymore. And, you know, my sponsor was somebody that I golfed with, and, you know, I worked in the family business, and that didn't work well, so I got out of that, and I got into, my sponsor worked at a bar, a friend of mine owned a bar, so I took a job in the bar. You know, I figured I could make a lot of money, I'm not drinking now. And soon enough, you know, I started to think that I dated a girl who drank at this time. You know, I really wasn't going to meetings, and you know, I thought that, you know, I had cleaned up the wreckage of my past. I didn't want to drink for effect. I didn't want to escape myself. I thought that, you know, I could drink like a normal human being. You know, this disease is cunning back. You know, it patiently waited for me for all those years for me to let down my guard. And it was right there, you know. And I said, you know what, worst comes to worst, I'll just come back into AA. So I picked up a drink shortly after my 7th anniversary. And over the next 5 years, I can say if you're thinking about going out or you're in that frame of mind to grab hold of somebody, because I'm telling you, I really shouldn't be here. You know, the next 5 years of my life were hell. You know, all my yets came true. You know, I went to jail. You know, I was homeless. You know, I robbed, stole, and you know, every line that I said I wouldn't cross, I crossed. And you know, I'm here today. You know, I thought I was going to die out there. I never thought I was going to get it again. I couldn't understand because I said, I know this works. You know, but I, you know, sometimes you just because you can't force it. You know, why I had to go through all that. And maybe it was because I had to feel that pain, or maybe it helped a lot of people to see me going in and out, suffering, you know, in and out of hospitals and all these things. And So I had hit a bottom, and I had called my sister. Now, years ago, I used to go to, you know, Hazel and things like that. But now I called my sister, and I went into a shelter. And then I went to a state-run rehab. And then I went to a halfway house. And, you know, I think when it's your time, it doesn't really matter where you go, you know. But I had to get off the streets because, you know, there are a lot of dry goods as part of my story, but I won't discuss them here. But I had to get off the streets for a while. I couldn't just go to meetings and things. And I came around, and, you know, I got a home group, and I got a sponsor. And I would love to say that was the end of it, but that's not the end of it. I moved into the city. I met a wonderful girl. I got engaged. And, you know, I went to a dentist to have a tooth pulled, and he prescribed me painkillers. And I didn't tell anybody. I think it was coming up on my year. I didn't really tell my sponsor about it. I didn't tell my fiancé about it and at the time. You know, I, like any, you know, alcoholic, I, you know, if it says one, I take two. I'm like bigger than the average guy. You know, I don't know what the average is, but I feel like I'm a little bigger, and then it turned to four, then six, and I'm on the internet, then, you know, everything started to snowball, and, the only reason I wasn't drinking at that time was because I was trying to hold on. I was full of fear of losing everything that, you know, all this, my family, my wife now. And my sponsor at the time, Stacy, came over. And, you know, just when you're open to hear somebody, he came over and it was like, I forgot what time. It felt like 3 o'clock in the morning. I don't know if that's it. But he said, Kevin, you're on an elevator and you're heading for disaster. You're going to die. And what floor you get off, I don't know. You know, I really don't know if there's hope for you. And, you know, I felt him. I just felt like that is the truth. This is it for me. If this, I'm going to die. I'm going to go to the end. I'm one of those, like, when I go out, I don't really try to control it. I just go, and that's it. And I heard him, and I came back. And just, you know, last week, I celebrated 2 years, and that's on my life. And I got married on Saturday. So... Now my wife is a little cunning, baffling, and powerful herself. But you know, if you're new and you're sitting there, what I have to tell you is that, you know, this works. It really does. You know, if you're not sure, stick around for 90 days. You know, and I used to say when I came around, you know, stay around for 90 days. At that time, you want to go back out, we'll gladly refund your misery, or you know, you'll save a couple of bucks. But you know, as soon as what I can say is how long. The sooner you get into action, the sooner your life will get better. Because obviously you put down a drink, things are going to get better at first. But then all of a sudden, I know for me, you know, when I first came around, I would start, you know, I abused working out, I abused shopping, you know, I just, my addiction switched. And, you know, I think that it's important. I mean, for we all suffered long enough. It's been my experience that the sooner you get into action, the better. And join a home group, get a sponsor that's gone through the 12 steps, and take some direction. Because your best thinking got you here. And, you know, I have sponsees today, they help me more than I help them. And I have a wonderful life. You know, my family's back in my life. And that's only because of this program. It really is a miracle. You know, when I first came around, my conception of God was, I hated God. You know, I was just like, you know, look at this world, it sucks. Excuse me, is that a curse? All right, anyways, I got to go. But my first higher power was my sponsor, then it was the rooms, and then it was, you know, then it was higher power. Now I just choose to call it God. But I know that the big book, that's its main purpose, is to bring us there. And it has done that for me. And I'm grateful that I've been asked this opportunity to speak. I hope I've helped somebody. And good night. Thanks.
And now, our next 10-minute speaker is Tanya.
I'm Tanya, I'm an alcoholic. This is funny. My drinking includes unpredicted urination, and I have a fear of, I'm like, nervous. but I'm actually not drunk, so in the event of anything that seems drunken, I'm not. I haven't had a drink, by God's grace, in well over 13 years. I haven't had a drink since my first AA meeting. I've never been to treatment. I got sober in high school, and I drank for 5 years. So for anyone who thinks they're too young or that they didn't drink enough, I actually have no dry goods in my story. And I used to invent that part because I felt like they're going to throw me out because I'm so young unless I did this other stuff too. So my early qualifications involved creative elaboration in that department that I no longer need to have. What it was like, the way I know my story and the way I know my alcoholism is that I had the alcoholism, then I had the drink, which relieved my alcoholism for a while, and now I have AA and a fellowship in God. And for me, the fear, doubt, insecurity that they talk about in the big book and the restless, irritable discontent, like, I had all of that long before I had a drink. I could have written a fourth step in elementary school, and it would have been long. I stole and I lied from the earliest age, and my parents are really, like, they're honest, like, good people. My mother's an immigrant from Ukraine, and, like, you know, 1 year she got an orange for Christmas. I mean, I just, like, you know, I just felt like, how did these folks get stuck with me? And extremely hardworking. I was raised in a home where, like, there were people who think and there were people who pray, and we don't pray. We had, like, a reference book in every room, like it was a Bible, and, like, you couldn't get through a meal without, like, 6 dictionaries and, like, the OED. And so the idea of something greater than ourselves was not something that I got much of at home. But I had this unbelievable fear, and I had this unbelievable anxiety, and I had this unbelievable anger. And, you know, I was born in Buffalo, and then we moved to Long Island, and it was like everyone was rich, and why didn't my parents send me to private school, and why didn't I know Latin? And, like, I mean, I had this, like, thing going long before I ever had a drink around, like, where's mine? I could not see what I had. And my brother could. And interestingly, like, I'm a drunk and my brother's not. So for me, like, that's, like, I really had alcoholism, where it says that liquor's a symptom, like, and we had to get down to causes and conditions. I had causes and conditions. I had a spiritual hunger, and I walked around like a kid who was starving, and I conducted myself in that way, and people had no idea what was going on with me. Like, he did not want me coming to a sleepover as, like, an 8-year-old. Like, I was in the porn, I was in the this, like, I was everywhere. And anyway, that's who I was. And I was told from an early age also, my father's father died of alcoholism, and my father's brother died of alcoholism, and there's lots of alcoholism in the family. But my parents didn't drink, and so they told me that I was likely genetically to have a, you know, so I, all I knew is that I wanted to drink. I was like, that sounds like a good idea. And I also, you know, was like, besides being a liar and a thumb sucker, I was insanely obsessed with scary books. So I was reading, like, all these Stephen King books. Like, by third grade, I'd read all of them. And I just was desperate to get out of myself. I started smoking at 7. By myself, I didn't want it blamed on peer pressure. I was making an informed choice. And that was me. I mean, I remember seeing ads for liquor and being like, I want to be there. You know, really little. Like, I requested a coffee liqueur birthday cake when I was 5. Like, none of the other kids, they were like, I don't want to eat this. I was like, good, more for me. Thank you. You know, you can go now. So by the time the drink came, I was so desperate for relief. Like, I really do remember getting on the school bus when I was in kindergarten and grabbing onto that metal bar and thinking, when will this be over? I am so tired. Like, I was really, like, exhausted by my alcoholism before I knew how to write in script. So at 12, I lost all my friends. It was like a junior high trauma. I wrote a note, which I now know was more like a fourth step than it was like a note. And the person with whom I chose to share that shared it with the grade, and I had no friends for like a year, and I made a decision. I wasn't going to be a girl anymore. I wasn't going to trust girls anymore, and I was done, and I started drinking. And my parents are, my dad's, anyway, this is my story, but my father weighs 450 pounds and is a host. So there's all kinds of, thank you, like, alcohol around that nobody drinks. And so I started pouring myself a drink after school, and I got this feeling of an exhale that I'd never experienced in my whole life. And I felt finally like I was just in one place at one time. And And luckily for me, I drank as much as I could as often as I could, and it didn't last very long. And I was a blackout drinker almost right away. I did things that made me extremely ashamed and embarrassed. Again, you know, with the various sort of things that you do behind closed doors, I was doing them in public, including taking off my clothes and, you know, doing whatever else. And I was not someone where, like, oh, if we could all be naked, it would be better. Like, I was like, if everyone could wear, a sack all the time, it would be better. Like, I was not someone for whom, like, this liberation was something I was interested in, you know, sharing with the lacrosse team. And that's what happened for me, is that I just had, you know, and that's that sort of thing where I can see now that the incredible shame that I felt growing up served me, because, like, I landed in an AA meeting when I was 17 years old. And, you know, I think, like, if I hated myself even an inch less, like, I don't know what else would have happened. But I really do think I was spared the 10 to 15 years of literal hell it talks about in the first step in the 12 and 12. And what happened for me is I landed in an AA meeting. I got sober in 1991. It was a big, like, Bradshaw talking about yourself in the third person time. And my father caught something on PBS, and somehow I ended up in Alateen, which, like, doesn't exactly make sense, but thank God for, like, the family fellowships, because they referred me to, they're like, who in your family drinks? I was like, who alive in my family drinks? They're like, yeah, who alive in your family drinks? And I was like, well, I guess I do. And they're like, okay, you should go to the young people's meeting on Friday. And, you know, the young people's meeting, I think the youngest person there was 50, and, it was on the North Shore of Long Island. It was the Northport group. They had ashtrays there that were, like, this big. Everyone was... My father worked at a psychiatric center growing up, and I know that thing where you inhale every time you put the cigarette to your mouth, but you never exhale. And I was like, I know what's going on here. But I still was like, if this is my penance, that's fine. The first meeting I ever went to was the 9-step meeting, so the next day I started to make my amends. I'm not joking. I called, like, the policeman father of the 7th grade friend where I drank the vodka at the birthday party. So I will say that the steps go in order for a reason. And for me, I have really benefited from working the steps with a sponsor who has been through the steps, and especially in 8 and 9, but really starting at 1. Like, it's amazing how much freedom can come from experience and from someone I trust. And I've had the privilege of now taking a lot of women through the steps just based on what I've been given. And there's no better thing. Like, that feeling of sitting with someone, with a woman, that's been my experience. I've worked the steps only with women. And hearing the 5th step, and just that thing of feeling useful and feeling like there's a line in the Big Book that says that, you know, our dark past is like the biggest treasure that we have, because with it we can save people's lives. And that saving isn't like the Superman thing. It's like being saved from that haunting, shame, relentless, chewing voice that wants me separate and dead. And that's what I've gotten from AA, is I'm less separate and I'm less dead every single day. And I graduated high school sober. I was like 5 months. I had blue hair, rainbow lunchbox, weighed a lot more than I do now. Like, I mean, I was, you know, to be sober, you need to not drink. And in my experience, going to AA helps a lot. But, like, I kind of did it, thank you. In a kind of whatever way, I ended up moving to a community where things were much looser, and I did not like the sobriety there. And I then realized not everyone was asking me to sponsor them. So I started studying the traditions, and I learned about how big AA really is. And I've lived in 4 different places sober. I've gotten plugged in everywhere I've gone. For anyone who has just relocated, get a sponsee. It makes things get grounded much faster. AA is the love of my life. It's given me a God. And I don't know. I'm glad to have a little grapevine man on my sticker. I've touched Ruth Hawk's typewriter. I just, like, it's the greatest show on earth. I just love this place, and I love the life that I get to have here. Thanks.
Tonight, our main speaker, please help me welcome Gino.
Hi, everybody. I'm Gino. I'm an alcoholic. That definitely sets the record for the most people to say hi, Gino, at one time, I'm sure of it. I'm very nervous. Like the former speakers, I want to thank Tanya and Kevin for speaking. And I want to thank the Atlantic Group for the reception that I got tonight, and for your structure. I think it's terrific. I haven't been here in a long time, and it is an overwhelming center of enthusiasm here, and it is so refreshing. I've been to AA meetings all over the world, I'm not all over the world. I haven't been in China or anything like that, but I've been in a lot of places, and I've checked in with AA everywhere I've gone, and I will tell you there is nothing like this meeting anywhere I've ever been. I haven't been to the Pacific Rim, but this is the place, man. This is unbelievable. I got to say more things like that. I like that. Anyway, I identify with Kevin's story a lot because I am a relapser, and I'll talk about that in my story. It is really an honor to be up here tonight. I only hope I give you a little bit of my story. I'm so nervous, but it's my story, and I'm going to tell it the way I can remember it right now. I feel like a deer in headlights. I started drinking as young as Tanya did, but wow, 17. I was just beginning my pickling process at that age. I had a long road ahead of me at 17. I started drinking very young. I had a mother who was an alcoholic. She was admitted an alcoholic. In fact, she used to go to rehab a lot, and I thought they were psych hospitals. I really did. I thought she was going to the loony bins. You know, when you're 7, 8, 9, and your mother's having fistfights with the rescue squad, being carted off on a stretcher, you think they're taking her to the flight deck. You know, you don't know that she's going to rehab. I had never heard of rehabs in those days, and a lot of people didn't hear of rehab in those days. Fair Oaks in New Jersey, that was a big one that she used to go to, and I remember one of the highlights of my life when I was 15. She told me to pick her up at Fair Oaks. She said, "Do you know, get a case of beer and a carton of cigarettes, throw it in the back of the Riviera, and come pick me up." Now, I'm telling you something. The only thing I could think of was like, all right, I get to drive. I'm only 15. This is great. I didn't even think about the beer and the cigarettes. And we were driving home. She let me drive, and I'm drinking beer with her. She's giving me beer in the car. We were a very heavy drinking family. My mother would have the alcohol delivered to the house. I had a couple of older sisters that loved to party, and we all drank together, man. We drank a lot, and we drank a lot as a family. I remember building a pyramid out of Schlitz cans in the basement, and we built a mega pyramid. I'm telling you, the thing was like 4 cases on the bottom, and it worked its way all the way up to the top. And this was, you know, one of the crowning achievements of my early drunkenness was putting that beer can on top in front of everyone at a party one time. I had to stand on the pool table to reach it. But this is the way it went for me. Drinking was a very normal part of my life. In fact, it was almost romantic. I can remember as a young kid watching my parents sit on the steps outside the front of our house, and they were drinking. They used to drink grasshoppers in those days. There was these green things with crushed ice and everything, and I just thought that was the coolest thing I ever saw. And then you'd see Clint Eastwood drinking whiskey in the movies on TV. And I actually, at a very young age, I used to go into my mother's cabinet and drink vinegar. Because it was the closest thing we had in the house that was drinkable that I thought was like whiskey. And I would make the same face Clint Eastwood. I'd shoot back a little shot of it and go, oh. So I kind of thought it was the same stuff. And I thought this was really cool, you know, the vinegar thing. And I didn't realize that this is the path that I was going on to be a drunk. I began drinking regularly around the time I was 15 years old. And when I say regularly, I mean I was drinking every day. I'm not one of those people that drank, you know, like every weekend, or, you know, drank every couple of weeks and then would stop for a while. I drank every day. I was calling in sick to high school with hangovers. My hangovers were very severe because I drank a lot, because we had a lot of booze in the house. And when you have this candy kitchen in front of you of different boozes, of, you know, all the cool bottles of Galliano and banana liquor and all this other stuff, you start trying them. You know, you pour a little in the glass every night. I'm saying a little. I would fill up water glasses and bring them up to my room at night and suck it back up. And this was devastating for a young man. You know, you're drinking, you know, 16, 18 ounces of hard liquor straight, and the next day I was really sick. And I don't know if they ever got on to me in high school, but I was calling in sick a lot. And my drinking progressed like that. And no one ever said anything about me drinking. I thought I was a normal drinker. You know, and the only thing that I thought was abnormal were my hangovers, because all my friends and I, we would go out. No one else would be throwing up in the morning, and I started that at a very early age. Throwing up is a very big part of my story. Sorry about that. If you don't like throwing up, leave now. So anyway, I at the end of my high school career, I got a job working in the restaurant. If you want to drink, get a job in a restaurant. It is the best place to have fun. You know, you become a busboy or a waiter or do the dishes, and it's just like free drinking all the time. And I didn't want to go to college. I didn't want to do anything. I didn't want to go to school. I didn't want to do nothing. And my dad made me go to college. My dad had moved out of my family very long. He was not much of a picture of my youth. He left when I was like 8 or 9 years old. So we were like running rampant with this house full of girls and me. You know, I had 4 sisters and myself and my mom. And it was the craziest scene you ever saw. And by the time I was ready to go off to college, I didn't want to go anywhere. My old man made me go to college. So he ships me off to my alma mater. So here is this young white kid from New Jersey who just wanted to drink in the middle of Iowa at the University of Iowa. Now, I'm not putting down Iowa, but this was not the place for me. What is the first thing any good drinker do, though, is he finds a place that will cash a check and serve an underage drinker beer. I do this immediately. Within 2 weeks, I found a gas station up the street that would take a check from my student account and would sell me, first time I ever saw it, a suitcase of beer. It's the first time I ever saw it. There was like 12 beers in one thing, and you could carry it by handle. And this was like heaven to me in a little box. And I made sure there was a little refrigerator in my dorm room. I had two roommates. And I proceeded to drink the way I knew how to do at college. I drank every day, all the time. That refrigerator never ran out of beer. And if I had $5 left and I was starving to death, I bought beer. Forget the food. I drank like that all the time. I drank like that every day. Boy, 17. That's unbelievable. I'm still thinking about that. When I was, after my freshman year at the University of Iowa, I went out to California. Because I hated Iowa, and I packed my bags one day, and I moved to California. This was just crazy. I was drunk, you know, and I called California. I said, you got colleges out there. I want to get into one. I flew to San Francisco. I got off the plane in San Francisco. I called up a local college, San Jose State, and I said, can I come down and register? They said, are you a resident? And I was like, yeah, I'm a resident of California. So wine was a big part of my story, too. So they let me register for college. And I started going to San Jose State University all on my own dime. I got a job in a restaurant again, which was the hotbed of my drinking career there. And I started living it up in California the same way I lived it up in New Jersey, the same way I would live it up in New York, as I drank every day. You know, I'm the alcoholic you can see in front of you. I poured so much booze into my body. I don't know why I'm standing here, to tell you the truth. I can't believe all my internal organs are not, like, you know, dead. I can't believe I haven't seized like an old Volkswagen engine. I drank every day to exhaustion. I drank until the booze was gone, and I would leave a little bit in the bottle so the next day when I woke up, when my hangover started kicking, I would have a little bit to straighten me out, just enough so I could get on with my day. I did that at San Jose State. I got into a terrible motorcycle accident. I was at a party. I borrowed this guy's motorcycle drunk, and I got into a really bad accident, really racked myself up. And I called my dad. I hadn't talked to him in years, and I said, I got to get out of here. My life is a ruin. He said, hey, come back and work for me in New York City. So I did. Came back and worked for him in New York City. Peggy will become part of my story soon. And I started doing the same thing in New York City, working for my dad, that I did in California, that I did in New Jersey, that I did in high school. I started drinking every day. The first thing I figured out was how to buy booze. Now, you know, I do have a lot of crazy things in my story. I skip over a lot of crazy events. I mean, I figured a lot of you people did similar things to what I did when I was drinking. I mean, I don't know if everyone threw explosives out of a van on Route 22 in New Jersey causing 10-car accidents like I did. I'm not sure if every single one of you peed out a window and hit the landlady walking between the two houses like I did, you know. But I did a lot of crazy things to get to AA, you know, and I don't have to tell you each and every one, because I know that every person sitting here in this room qualifies to sit in this room, did something crazy in your drinking career, whatever it was. I know you got it in my head, but by the time I got back to New York City, funnily enough, I almost felt done. I was so sick, and I was so tired, but I still went on, and I still did it, because my father was, God bless him, he was a great enabler. He let me work in his company, and he let me get away with so much crap. I called in sick every Monday for like 4 years. I had the flu more often than the Center for the Disease Control in Atlanta. Every Monday, I have the flu again. I won't be in. And my hangovers were really severe. I was throwing up blood by this point. One of my lovely throw-up stories is I began to throw up a lot of blood. And that didn't make me scared. And I never thought it was my drinking. I never thought it was what I was doing to myself. I thought it was my nerves. You know, I was one of those guys, if you had my life, if you had my job, if you had this girlfriend, if you had my dad, you'd be drinking too. You'd feel this way too. I thought I had a nervous condition. So I was going to all these doctors, and they were giving me all these great pills. You know, I was getting the Tagamet, the Imodium, and the Compazine, and all that other crap. And I never was honest with a doctor a day in my life about what I was drinking. You know, I never said a word to these guys about how much tequila with Tabasco sauce I had drank over the weekend. That's called a prairie fire. And I drank a lot of those. A typical night of my drinking was 3 bottles of wine, a pint of tequila, and other substances mixed in there. By the time I got to 1988, my life was an absolute shambles. Now, a couple years before that, someone came to work in my dad's company named Peggy. This Peggy right here. She became the chief financial officer of my dad's company. Oh, is that breaking your arm? No? Okay. Sorry. Peggy came jangling into my father's company, and I hated her. From the very beginning, that woman came in here. She will confirm this. We were at odds from the moment she walked into that company. She was so well-dressed, and wore so much jewelry. And everything, the scarf on the hair matched the outfit, matched the shoes. And I'm sitting there, hungover, throwing up in the bathrooms with a t-shirt that's too tight. I'm all bloated. My eyes are red. My breath smells like puke. And it comes Peggy jangling in, saying, "Good morning, everyone. Life is wonderful. I love everybody." I'm hitting her. We become at odds immediately. We're sending nasty memos to everyone in the company about each other. And Peggy is standing her ground. I mean, every nasty memo I send, she sends another one. Every joke I play, she plays another one. One morning, and this is a true story, one morning with a terrible hangover after a typical one of my three-bottle drunks, I walk into Peggy's office and I say, "Boy, I'm not feeling well this morning." And she says, "Oh, do you have the flu again?" Where this comes from, folks, I don't know, but I said to her, "No, Peggy, I drank too much last night." I don't know where that came from. I never planned on saying, especially to her. I'm telling you, my dislike was intense at this point. I mean, we were like enemies of the company. And I don't know where it came from. The only thing I know now is that my higher power reached down and slapped me on the back of the head and said, "Speak." Because I'd never heard of rehab. I didn't know anything about it. In fact, all I knew about rehab was Dwight Gooden from the New York Mets had just got into rehab. And I was like, "There's a place you can go for your drinking?" I had no idea. That also, I didn't know anything about AA except the movie Days of Wine and Roses, which was a horrible, depressing black and white thing where Jack London was staggering around the whole time and they're pouring alcohol on him on the street and everything. So I thought it was a bunch of bums in church pews and black and white and everything. And I had nothing to do with any of that. I didn't know anything about that. And I go to Peggy's office one day and I say, "I drank too much last night." She said, "Oh, you think you have a problem?" I was like, "Oh, no, it was last night. Life is tough, life's rough. I had a tough day yesterday and I drank a little too much last night. I'll be fine." Sorry, I immediately got embarrassed. I left. I think it was like the next morning I did the same thing. I walked in and I said, "You know, I drank again too much last night." She said, "Do you think you had a problem?" I said, "You know, I don't know, Peg. I don't know. It was the first time I ever evaluated those things in my life. I had never evaluated my drinking after all these years of drinking. This is what? This is like 16 years of really hard drinking. I never took a hard look at what I was pouring into my body. Not once. I was one of those people that had a thought that I drank because I had a terrible life. I didn't know until I got here that I had a terrible life because I was drinking that whole time. I never had a chance at life because I was drinking so much, so often. You know, we talk about it in the first and second steps all the time. Oh, here I go with the steps again. Van told me to be a big book thumper, by the way, and I'm kind of into that, but I didn't realize that I was so powerless over the substance that the minute I poured it into my body, all the rest of my life went away, and that I made everything disappear for the sake of getting that drink, like I heard in the second step, is just, that's all I could think about. And I never knew that stuff. So Peggy one day, she says, "Do you think you have a problem?" I say, "I don't know." The next day, I think it was, she brought me AA literature. She said, "I have some friends that know a little bit about this. Take a look at this stuff." I was so mortified. She handed me like 4 pamphlets. To this day, I have no idea what pamphlets are there. I was like, oh, I went right out of her office. I threw them in someone else's garbage can for fear someone might see that crap in my garbage can. I couldn't believe this woman had the gall to give me AA literature. This threw me into the depths of despair like you have no idea. I went home to my apartment that night. I said, "My life is over. Someone thinks I need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous." You know, I heard the da-da-da in the background. I really thought my life was over as I stood on my balcony drinking wine and watching the people on the street going back and forth, and I had that hatred for other people that looked like they had a life. I don't know if you can identify with that, but I read this book by Chuck C. called New Pair of Glasses that my sponsor Huey gave me. He's here. He came with me tonight. And there's a diagram in that book where he describes how he felt when he was drinking. Thank you. There's a big circle that he draws an arrow to, and he says, "This is the universe with all the little dots inside of it." And then there's a line, and there's a stick figure on the other side of the universe that says, "Me." And that's how I felt all those years. I felt completely separate from the universe. And I would be so angry at people as I would look at them from my balcony thinking, these people have a place to go, they have friends, they have a life, they've got something. And I had nothing. I felt that the cards I were dealt were crap, and that's what I was. And I felt hatred. I hated everybody. And Peggy asked me if I wanted to go to rehab. We were discussing it. And I said, "Well, you know, what's this rehab thing about? I don't know much about it." So she said she would do a little research. She came back to me with 5 rehab names. And I did not know Peggy was in AA. Peggy does not break her anonymity. And we discussed the fact that I basically said I think the world would stop turning if I left the New York City area, so anything in Minnesota was out of the question. So we settled on Smithers Rehab in New York City. And I, in front of Peggy now, mind you, I took the induction test with the nurse over the phone. And for the first time ever in front of anyone, I was honest about how much I drank on the phone that day. How much you drink? Well, like 3 bottles of wine, a lot of tequila in there too, you know, just straighten out the taste of the wine, you know, because you get that first shot of tequila down, you get those shakes and everything, and then you feel like you're going to throw up, and then it passes really fast, and the glow starts. And the nurse is like, okay, all right. I blurted all up early, honestly. Was there any drugs in your store? Yeah, occasionally, yeah. I would, you know, would handle the drugs like I would handle anything else. Put a couple of belts of booze in me, and I'm off doing anything you want. Hey, let's go to Las Vegas. Hey, have some drugs. I'm like, fine, give me anything. It's great. And I took the induction test, and I was too embarrassed to go. The nurse basically told me that we have a bed for you right now, and I was too embarrassed to go. And I went out, and I needed to drink a little bit more. And then I had a really long run of me, like a 5-day period where I didn't go to work. I drank. I was permanently on the side of my couch with the remote on the TV like this, drinking. The liquor store would deliver because I couldn't get out of bed. It got to the point where I was so weak I was actually throwing up on the paper on the side that I had put on the floor because I just couldn't move. I was like gone. And I called my sister, which I identified with Kevin, and I said, you know, I've been talking to this rehab and I think I'm in trouble and I don't think I can do anymore. And I wound up going to Smithers straight from New York Hospital where they were treating me for like dehydration, throwing up blood, another one of those rounds with the emergency room. But my sobriety story doesn't really start there yet, because I didn't get sober in July 88 when I went to Smithers. I came out of Smithers and I started going to meetings, and I ran into Peggy at Midtown, which was downstairs in this meeting, and I said, Peggy, what are you doing? I actually thought, Peggy's nephew's in the rooms too, and I thought that Peggy came to the meeting to support her nephew. I was like, Peggy, that's so cool that you're here to support Jimmy and all this. And I was effusive and everything. And she sat me down and she gave me my first big lesson on anonymity, which basically consisted of a bat with a big book, and said, you tell anyone and you get this. And she gave me a very long explanation on why not to break into anonymity and all that. And I listened very carefully, and I never did to this day. And I proceeded to have fun in AA. I wasn't throwing up anymore. I felt good in the mornings. I started to exercise. I started to take vitamins by the handful. I was taking so many vitamins that the guy at the health food store would see me coming in and he would just stop doing whatever he was doing and goes, hey! Because I'd find bottles and bottles and bottles. I was taking lecithin and B and C and A and all of the selenium and everything I could think of that I thought would reverse the course of problems in my body. And I started dating. I remember finding my first higher power, Miss February 86. She was terrific, and I had a lot of fun in AA, man. I went to dances, and I hung out, and I picked up girls with the mustard seed, and I really, really, really had fun. But then when Miss February 86 decided to screw me over and leave me for another man, I was devastated. Oh, God, am I devastated? Anyway, I'm being sarcastic, but I had no spiritual program at this point. See, Dan told me later on that AA is a program with 12 steps, and I had never done any of those steps. I was given the gift of step none when I came in, and I learned how to go to dances, and I learned how to share at meetings, and I actually would sit at meetings and talk about steps. I would invent what I thought they meant on the window shade, and I was like, yeah, my life is really insane because I had a big fight with my dad at work today, and oh boy, am I crazy, I don't know. I just wanted to share. I was, you know, the seagull sharing, swoop in, drop your crap, and swoop out. And I just really thought this was the sober way, you know. And as it turns out, I had no defense against the first drink. So after about 4.5 years in AA, when life became crippling and I became depressed, I had no choice but to treat myself. And the treatment was either a spiritual program or drinking. And I chose drinking again. And I remember Peggy asking me if I was going to go celebrate my 5th anniversary. I was like, yeah, I don't think so. We were still working at this point. I had been lying about it. I stopped going to meetings, and I didn't want anything to do with anybody, and I really thought my life was over again. I want to tell you how quickly alcohol takes you back. It drags you by the throat, and it throws you down, and it stomps on your neck, and it takes you back like you would not believe. It kills you. And it kills you fast. I can't tell you how fast I was back throwing up blood, throwing up in my car on the way to work. I can't tell you how fast my life became a shambles again. And after like 5 months of doing this, I called my first sponsor, Victor, and I said, Victor, I I'm drinking. I got to get back into AA. I'm dying here. And we set a date, and I went back to a meeting. And I called Peggy, and I had talked to her about it briefly, and I went back, and here's another intervention by my higher power. I walked up to the guy I hated hearing the most in AA, the guy that constantly talked about the friggin' blue thing all the time, the big book, over and over again. And I said, "Van, will you be my sponsor?" He stood in front of me and he snaps open a big book, the page, I think it was 23, and he goes, "What does it say in AA?" He goes, "You know, if you want what you got, you know, keep doing what you're doing. If you want what we got, you got to do what we did." And he snaps it close and he said, "That's right! You're going to call me every morning at 9:30. Don't be late. You got a 5-minute slot." And I got to tell you something. This guy taught me sobriety. I mean, he gave it to me like Peggy gave me the anonymity lesson. He gave me sobriety with a bat because he knew I needed it. He made me do service. He made me learn the steps. He sat with me in diners and he took me through the big book. And I was amazed at the stuff he taught me. I could not believe that this program existed. I mean, for all these, like, 5 years, I was founding around AA, and I had no idea these pearls of wisdom were in the big book. I mean, I can't tell you what it's like to read the big book for the first time and to really discover your drinking story and what made you drink. And he realized I was so thick, he would actually draw me diagrams. Do you remember that in the car when you did the second step? He just, "Here's a big circle, and here's a little slice of pie. Your mind is the big circle missing the slice of pie that tells you not to drink. God is that slice of pie. He will return you to sanity and help you not drink again." And I was like, "Okay, I get it. I get it." And I very, very, very slowly began to get the AA program. And he took me through every single step like that. I remember he told me when he started me on the third step, he made me memorize the third step prayer, which I will tell you today is a lifesaver for me. Quick story, I had to go to the Department of Motor Vehicles this morning. This is how I use the third step prayer, because as I'm waiting there for 3 hours, frustrated and upset, "God, I offer myself today, God, I offer myself today, God, I offer myself today." I'm saying this thing like a mantra instead of like, "I'm going to kill the person behind the counter. Why aren't they taking me? God, I offer myself today." I would say I pace back and forth, and I use that prayer to save myself over and over again from going off the deep end. I had to memorize that, and then he gave me the three frogs sitting on the log. Have you heard that one? This mystified me for like 3 days. Three frogs are sitting on a log. One decides to jump off. How many are left? Two. No. He would hang up on me when I was wrong. Next day, three frogs are sitting on a log. One decides to jump off. How many are left? And now I'm getting nervous. I'm getting nervous. Two. No. Damn. Finally, he explains it to me. He says, there's three frogs sitting on a log. One just made a decision. He didn't take an action. Oh. Oh. Okay, I got it. I got it. Then I confided in him one day that I don't really understand God, because I was godless and religious and my whole life. I didn't hate God because I didn't have a God. I didn't know from God. I didn't know anything. And at this point, I was really trying because I was really serious about AA and I was doing everything they asked me to do at the Atlanta group. And I was listening. I was begging. I was preaching. I was wanting to get this thing, but I had no higher power and I couldn't find him. And he said, "That's fine. That's God as you understand him." And I was able to move on with the steps. I couldn't understand why people always said, turn it over. Now I hear those people say, "Turn it over today." And I say, "You know what? I know how to turn it over now because I have a process to turn it over. It's like 4 through 12, you know. I do that process now. I live in steps 10, 11, and 12. I only have 5 minutes left. I got sober. Van and Peggy helped me get sober. To make a long story short, I wound up falling in love madly with Peggy. I wound up finding God through Van and Peggy and Alcoholics Anonymous. I wound up going to Roman Catholic Church and becoming a Catholic because of Peggy. Peggy is my godmother. I'm not making that up. Peggy is my godmother. I had to make amends with Peggy. I had to make amends with a lot of people in my life. And I did them because every time I did something, Van would say, "You have a choice. You can do this or you can risk drinking again." And I look back over all the things that I did in the steps, and all those things are a protection to keep me from drinking again. And if you're a relapser, if you're here today and you're coming back to the program, or if you don't have a lot of time and you drank again, I want to tell you that it's possible for you to stay sober, because I did it. I'm in my 11th year of sobriety now after my relapse, and I thank God for that relapse. One big event did happen to me when I came in here. I have a sister who was very ill with drug addiction, and I prayed for her to be helped so many times. I took her to rehabs myself. Funny story, when I was still drinking, she went to rehab before me. I took her down to a place called Taylor Manor in Baltimore. We drove all night drinking and partying, and we get down to Taylor Manor, and she goes into the ladies' room, and I'm out there, and the induction guy comes in, and he starts to interview me, and he's asking me all these questions. And I thought, this is so cool. You're taking, like, a family interview. And she comes out of the bathroom, and she says, I'm here. And he looks up at his clipboard, and looks at her, and he goes, oh. And I didn't realize until a couple years ago that he actually thought I was the patient, because I was drunk off my mind. I'd been driving down with her all night. To make a long story short, when I was in my fifth year, my sister died of a heroin addiction with her husband in front of their 11-year-old daughter. And I had to go down, and I remember calling Huey, who's my sponsor now, from her room, and I said, she's lying there dead on the bed. And I was kind of freaking out. And the apartment was filled with drugs. I mean, you've never seen anything like what heroin addicts live like. And I'm not putting them down by any means, but her apartment was like a hovel, and there was drugs everywhere. It was all over the place. They were in vials. They were in packets. They were in syringes. And I was devastated. The police were there, and everything was nasty. And they were asking me to identify their bodies. And Huey said to me, look at that face on the bed very carefully, because if you pick up anything in that apartment, your face is the next one on the bed. And I never forgot that. And I'm not going to cry. But that took a lot of toll on my family. It took a lot of toll on me, having to go to a couple of funerals, having to sit through my little sister's death like that. The wreckage that it left in my family and in my heart was unbelievable. And it taught me something that I will never forget. We are here by God's grace. This is not our choice to be here. We don't fight kicking and scratching and clawing and then have victory over something. We got to AA because God wants us to be here. And we have to relish every minute of this and try to pass it on to other people and hold those gates of hope and hold those gates of hell open, because my sister was smarter and younger and more talented than I was. And God took her and killed her. I don't know why I'm here alive, but she's not. I have no answer for that except that I have grace. And I use that grace every day. I go to AA. I sponsor guys. I'm married now. I have two beautiful little sons. And changing diapers is a lot like sponsoring guys, I will tell you that. You got to put up with a lot of crap and they don't appreciate it at all. But I am very, very, very grateful to be here today. Like I said, I've been coming to the Atlantic Group for many, many years. I haven't been here because we moved way up in Westchester. Thank you. And it is a difficult commute for me to get here, but I am very grateful to be here. I have seen many, many unbelievable speakers here from Clancy on down over the course of the years, and I am so honored to join the ranks of the 30-minute speakers here. And my wishes for you is that one day everyone here wakes up inside that circle of the universe like I did in AA. Thank you.